This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
a new report from Save the Children says each year 15 million girls are married before the age of 18. Some are as young as 10. The aid organization estimates there are 700 million women around the world today who were married in childhood.
That's VOA's Joe DiCapua reporting. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also, stone-throwing university students confronted riot police for a second day today in Johannesburg, South Africa. Moroccan police arrest 10 women who had allegedly pledged allegiance to the Islamic State. And a new report reveals that the burden of malnutrition is equivalent to that of experiencing a global financial crisis every year. We'll have these stories and more, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, stone-throwing university students confronted riot police for a second day today in Johannesburg, South Africa. The Associated Press says police used rubber bullets to disperse the crowds. Students at Witwatersrand University are calling for free higher education. The government says it cannot afford to meet their demands, but says it will pay for fee increases for poor students next year. Also in South Africa, officials say the country's finance minister, Pravin Gordhan, will be prosecuted for fraud. He's charged with illegally authorizing an early retirement package for a colleague when he headed South Africa's revenue service several years ago. AFP says Gordhan has clashed repeatedly with President Zuma's loyalist after promising to fight corruption. He had been appointed by Mr. Zuma last year after the president had fired two previous finance ministers. The head of the National Prosecuting Authority denies any political motive. The incident has affected investors' confidence, with the rand falling nearly 3.5% against the dollar after the announcement. Moroccan police have arrested 10 women who had allegedly pledged allegiance to the Islamic State. Authorities say they plan to carry out suicide bombings across the country and were training other women in several Moroccan cities. Ambassador Alberto Fernandez is the vice president of the Middle East Research Institute and a former director of the U.S. State Department Center for Strategic Counterterrorism Communications. Reporter Mohammed El-Shenawi asked him why Muslim women should consider becoming terrorists.
The attraction of the Islamic State in terms of propaganda, in terms of the image that it promotes, continues to be powerful. It's lost some of its appeal because of some of the military defeat, but it's still attracting converts, still attracting people who want to take direct action. It's interesting, of course, unusual in this case because they're women, but we've seen cases of in recent weeks of women in Europe, women from Trinidad who tried to go to Turkey to join the Islamic State, and also in the West. So they're clearly looking for people to do things for the state, either go there or to carry out activities in their home countries.
The female terrorist cell was recruiting and training women in several parts of the country. What do you make of that?
Well, what happens is, of course, the Islamic State is adept in using technology to groom people, especially vulnerable people, young people, confused people, women, people searching for identity, and in some cases actually even use women to recruit women to carry out attacks. So this is the sophisticated process of radicalization that goes on through social media, through contacts, to get people to take action in the name of Dawla al-Islamiyya, the Islamic State.
Morocco says more than 150 terrorist cells have been uncovered since 2002, including dozens in the past 3 years with ties to jihadists in Iraq and Syria. What attracts Moroccan youth in particular to radicalism when their country espouses a very moderate version of Islam?
Well, what happens, of course, is that you're talking, first of all, about a minority of the population, but you're talking about a certain percentage of the population, a minority percentage, which is attracted to the worldview of Salafi jihadism. So it's never the majority, but the appeal is there. We've had investment by Salafis and by Salafi jihadists in propaganda, education, media for decades now. This is the bitter fruit of those decades of investments in poison. We're seeing youth that have been radicalized, whose minds have been filled with this toxic material. So again, it's a minority of the population, but in some places it's a significant minority.
Is using female terrorists a new tactic from ISIS?
No. I mean, the first female suicide bomber from the West, for example, that the Islamic State used was in 2005, a Belgian woman. And in fact, in 2005, the Islamic State also used a woman, or tried to use a woman, to bomb a wedding in Amman, Jordan. This is Al-Qaeda in Iraq before it became the Islamic State, but it's the same organization. So they've been doing this for over a decade now.
That was Ambassador Alberto Fernandez of the Middle East Research Institute in Washington. He was speaking with reporter Mohammed El-Shanawi. Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel has recommended that Ethiopia's prime minister hold talks with demonstrators. She spoke today during a joint press conference with Prime Minister Hailemariam Desalegn in Addis Ababa. Ms. Merkel is on a three-nation African tour to offer help on issues driving African migrants to European shores. 2 days ago, Ethiopia declared a national state of emergency after clashes in which protesters burned and ransacked several businesses. Protesters said the businesses took their land. The government has blamed what it calls foreign enemies for inciting the protests. It has accused Egypt of supporting terrorists in the country. A new report from Save the Children says each year 15 million girls are married before the age of 18. Some are as young as 10. The aid organization estimates there are 700 million women around the world today who are married in childhood. The report was released today, the International Day of the Girl. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The Save the Children report is entitled Every Last Girl. Free to live, free to learn, free from harm. President and CEO Carolyn Miles describes child marriage as an enormous problem.
One girl under 15 is married every 7 seconds, and it's a big piece of what's holding girls back. What happens when a girl gets married at a young age is she drops out of school. She will probably have a baby very shortly after getting married at 13 or 14. That's very dangerous for the mom, so the maternal mortality rate for young mothers is much higher. The child mortality rate for her child is going to be much higher.
The report ranks which countries are the best and worst places to be a girl. Miles says the top-rated countries are in Scandinavia.
Sweden comes out on the top, followed by Finland, Norway, Netherlands, and Belgium. There's very low rates of child marriage, teen pregnancy, maternal mortality rate is low. Almost all girls complete secondary school and go beyond that, obviously. And there's a lot of representation of women in the highest level of government, which we think is important in setting policies that are going to help women and girls.
The United States ranks 32nd among the best places for girls to live. Miles reveals who's at the bottom of the rankings of 144 countries.
Well, the worst place to be a girl is in Niger, and that's followed by Chad, Central African Republic, Mali, and Somalia. So these are all African countries. They are all countries as well that have internal conflict or have recently come out of civil wars and conflicts. These are situations that are particularly dangerous for girls.
The world's newest country, South Sudan, ranks 132nd. Of the 38 countries at the bottom of the list, only three are not sub-Saharan African, namely Afghanistan, Bangladesh, and Yemen.
These are countries that, in addition to a lot of them being conflict countries, they're obviously very poor.
The Save the Children chief says many child marriages are arranged by families.
One of the things that makes it so hard is you're really trying to change behavior. And what you're trying to convince families, frankly, is that girls are as valuable as boys in terms of going on and getting an education and being able to have a productive life.
She says the organization works closely with communities to encourage behavior change and create a safe environment to reject child marriage.
One of the things that we have found is really successful is if you have some very high-level leadership on these issues. And I'll give you an example. It's a country that's really near the bottom. It's Sierra Leone. But there, the First Lady has actually said, I am not going to see this happening to my girls in Sierra Leone. She is leading a campaign, really, against early marriage and against violence against girls.
Ending child marriage by 2030 is part of the UN Sustainable Development Goals.
If 50% of your population is not as productive as they could be, as healthy as they could be, as having the opportunities that they could take up, then your country's not going to develop.
Save the Children warns if current trends continue, the total number of women married in childhood will grow from 700 million today to around 950 million by 2030. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. As the economic crisis in Zimbabwe worsens, the country needs a bailout. The government of Robert Mugabe is now heavily in debt, but no donor has offered a relief package. Even China, which has invested heavily in Zimbabwe, has not offered assistance. Former U.S. Ambassador to Namibia, George Ward, is a researcher at the Institute for Defense Analysis in suburban Washington. He spoke with VOA's David Arnold about Zimbabwe's political and economic dilemma.
There have been discussions between the government of Zimbabwe and the international financial institutions. Whether they involve a specific package or not, I don't know. There have been various media reports, but I've also seen denials by the World Bank that there is a specific package that is being discussed. One of the reasons, perhaps, that these discussions have not proceeded to a level of detail is because Zimbabwe has not been able to assemble financing necessary to attend to its current debts, which have prevented it from receiving assistance from the World Bank and the IMF.
Could you describe the current condition of their debt?
I don't have those figures right in front of me. There is a considerable indebtedness. I believe the figure that I have on the back of my mind is $1.8 billion. That may be a bit inaccurate. There were reports at one point that Zimbabwe was attempting to assemble a package of bilateral loans from various sources that would have enabled them to service their current debt. But as far as I've seen, that hasn't worked out. So the World Bank and IMF activity has not proceeded further.
Where would these other funds come from?
Because they haven't materialized, I don't know, but there were reportedly discussions with a number of financial institutions and individual countries.
But if they don't get these funds from these individual countries, what alternative do they have?
The government's room for maneuver right now financially is very, very limited because the reforms that they would need to undertake to improve their standing with the international institutions would involve reduction of government spending, reduction of currently 80% of the government's budget is spent on salaries. The civil service is bloated with employees, and yet the government party is dependent upon the support of those public sector employees politically and finds it very difficult to take meaningful measures to reduce the size of the public sector. That is probably the single greatest hurdle that it has in terms of being able to qualify for additional assistance.
Is there anywhere else for the government to turn?
The government seems to have started to move in that direction a couple of times over the past several months, but each time, as far as I've seen, it's had to turn aside and before the reforms were actually put in place, so that at one point there was a pledge to reduce the size of the civil service, as far as I've seen, has not materialized.
This then could enter into the domestic politics, and particularly those of the of ZANU-PF, in which Generation 40 seems to be interested in finding a resolution to the question of succession, if not reforms within the party.
The major factor is the continued focus by President Mugabe on preserving his power, on keeping his options open. The factional fighting within ZANU-PF is apparently real, and yet neither side has the upper hand. The security chiefs seem to remain fairly firm in the support of the faction led by Vice President Ngangwa, and the strength of the G40 group is, to me at least, a bit unclear. So the prospects for positive change in Zimbabwe remain very cloudy, both on the political and on the international financial side. One country that, in my opinion, would have significant leverage is China, because China holds so much of Zimbabwe's debt and has been responsible for such significant projects within the country. And, of course, is the object of President Mugabe's look east policy. But I have not seen signs of Chinese engagement, certainly at any declarative public level, nor in working with the government on a package that might result in a domestic economic policy that would be conducive with a resumption of multilateral international financial assistance.
That was former U.S. Ambassador George Ward of the Institute for Defense Analysis in suburban Washington. He spoke with VOA's David Arnold about Zimbabwe. A new report reveals that the burden of malnutrition is equivalent to that of experiencing a global financial crisis every year. The study also warns that right now, one out of every three people worldwide is malnourished. And if no action is taken to improve diets now, the number of malnourished will soon increase to one out of two people in the world. The study conducted by the Global Panel on Agriculture and Food Systems for Nutrition focused on how people's diets around the world are changing and how they are affecting their health and nutrition. Dr. Lawrence Haddad, Senior Research Fellow for the International Food Policy Research Institute, IFPRI, in the UK, is one of the researchers of the study. He says the study found the combination of not having enough food and a poor balance of foods is a bigger risk factor for health than unsafe sex, tobacco, alcohol, and drug use combined.
We looked at diets around the world and we found that some things are getting better and some things are getting worse. So the consumption of some things is improving that are good for health, such as fruits. The consumption of some things that are good for health, such as vegetables, is pretty much flat. And then the consumption of some things which are less good for health and nutrition, such as sugary sweet drinks, trans fats, sodium, those things are increasing. It's a really mixed picture.
Dr. Haddad stresses that as people's incomes in sub-Saharan Africa increase, so does the risk of a poor diet. While some people may be able to afford better food, they may also buy unhealthy food because it is more attractive and may taste better. He says countries need to make their food systems a priority in terms of supporting the growth and marketing of a variety of nutritional foods.
What the report does is identify lots of choices that policymakers can make to make food systems better support higher quality diets. And because this is quite a complex space, the report introduces a couple of tools that help policymakers navigate their own particular space.
The report also revealed that one of the biggest drivers of unhealthy food choices is urbanization. Dr. Haddad explains why urbanization is a big contributor of poor diets.
Urbanization creates these concentrated markets for big food companies and retailers to come in and sell lots of stuff. A lot of the stuff is healthy, but also a lot of the stuff is unhealthy. Urbanization means that, especially in slum conditions, many households don't have cooking facilities. So they have to buy food on the street, or they have to buy prepared food that's ready to eat. And a lot of this food is unsafe. It's produced with really unhealthy oils that are high in saturated and trans fats. It's got lots of sugar and salt in it to make it tasty and attractive. Combined with, in urban settings, there's more of a sedentary lifestyle.
Dr. Haddad says urbanization also plays a key role in unhealthy diets in the growing economies of sub-Saharan Africa, and countries need to start changing their food systems. He says there are a number of ways this can be done, but there are major challenges that must be addressed in doing this.
We've got to do two things. We've got to step on the accelerator to get levels of hunger down. The report cites some projections from FAO that show there are about 200 million people in sub-Saharan Africa that are hungry today. And it says actually in 2030, that same number will be hungry. So African policymakers have to make sure that hunger is reduced. And they also have to step on the brake when it comes to things like diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, cancer. So to do that, they've got to increase investments in agricultural R&D to get the productivity of cereals up, because that's what makes farmers wealthier. It allows them to get better income, to buy better food.
Dr. Haddad highlights a number of actions countries can take to improve people's diets. One major step farmers can take is to dramatically increase investment in the research and development of fruits, vegetables, and pulses, which are edible seeds from legumes and are high in fiber and protein. He says these foods are in low consumption in sub-Saharan Africa. He also points out they need to be made more attractive for farmers to grow, and the price of these foods should be affordable enough for consumers to be able to purchase them. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. In news elsewhere, nearly 1.5 million people in Haiti are reported in need of humanitarian assistance after being battered last week by Hurricane Matthew. Haiti had major problems even before the storm. It's been battling a cholera epidemic that began 9 months after the devastating 2010 earthquake. There have been about 900,000 cases since then and at least 10,000 deaths. Matthew has caused an increase in new infections. The World Health Organization is sending 1 million new doses of cholera vaccine to Haiti. It's also requested $120 million in aid. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Afori, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Escape from the humdrum and dance to the beat of an African drum. Hi, I am David Van, host of the Voice of America's African Beat. Splendid sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. Join me Monday through Friday at 0900 and 2000 UTC for a soothing musical jam. I guarantee it.
The best footballers must have dedication and teamwork. And to end malaria, we need this same unity. Malaria stops footballers from scoring and children from learning. Join with footballer Didier Drogba
Malaria is preventable and treatable.
Join with leaders like President Kikwete.
United, we can beat malaria.